The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
I'll show you a couple of things a couple of things that I meant to show you yesterday and I just forgot. Again, like I said, put your depression catch back on. But this is some stuff I got from. This is stuff that's right from the horse's mouth here. Okay, let's look at Al Qaeda. This is the one that I got in trouble on the plane going to Charlotte. Okay. All right. So this is just, there's no notes for this, but this is just, I'm just trying to give you some heads up stuff on this. Al Qaeda's plan to Islamicize the world in 15 years. Now, it's probably a lousy plan, but it's kind of eerie when you, it comes from Newsmax, there you go. It's kind of eerie when you think about it. This is based on an interview with an Al Qaeda operative. All right, now this is, they have like a seven phase plan. Okay. All right, so there's their master plan. Yeah, they think they can do it. They can, make the world an Islamic state by 2020. Okay, that seems to be a key time for them. And they feel that they'll have rough parity with so-called Christians, you know. Okay, so there you go. Saud Hussein interview. Blah, 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 blah. All right. Okay, so that tells you who this is. So you know these aren't any fly-by-night kind of guys. Okay, so according to his plan, according to the deal, he says phase one will be the awakening. 9/11 attacks were designed to provoke us into declaring war on the Islamic world. So Bush so many times says this is not a war against Islam, this is a war against terrorism. He said that time and time and time again. But when you hear these guys to say it's a war against Islam, you got it? It's a propaganda thing. Perception is reality, okay? And by that, they hope to mobilize Islamic radicals. Well, I think, do you see my point about having to be tough? You got to be tough. You got to be absolutely, they do that to get you to fight. Phase two, then, the opening of eyes. All right, opening eyes. The terrorists hope to make the Western conspiracy aware of the Islamic community. Conspiracy. Aware of the Islamic community. All right. In other words, they just want to say, hey, we're here. We're here. All right. Al-Qaeda will continue from its secret, to form a secret battalions. Okay. Secret battalions. Now, when we look at the video today, you're going to see what I'm talking about. They're already working on that stuff. All right. All right. This should go until about 2006. All right. That's his deal. All right. Phase three. Okay. Arising and standing up. Frequent attacks will be made against secular Turkey. Well, they got a thing about Turkey, you know. They can't deal with it. Okay. Israel. Of course, it's their arch enemy. Why? Because it's not Islamic, you know. Okay. That should go until 2010. Now, again, Israel. We're talking about Al-Qaeda. We're talking about a Sunni group. We're talking about Hamas. Again, you know. Of course, Hezbollah is going to do their thing. I've got Hezbollah's deal on this, dude. All right? The Shiites. This is a Sunni thing. Okay. The Persian. All right. Phase four. All right. Hated Arab regimes will fall. Okay. You see, when I'm sharing with that stuff, this is right from the horse's mouth, you know. And I was telling you about their ideology. They hate Arab regimes that are not strictly adhering to Sharia. Okay, Saudi Arabia, Jordan. The oil suppliers will be attacked. All right. Of course, you know that'll happen. The U.S. economy will be targeted with cyber terrorism. You see, that's where I get that from. I'm not making these things up. Okay, I'm telling you, sometime in the not too distant future, there's going to be a major cyber attack. You know? All right. And this should last until 2013. So we're in time of danger. So when I discovered this, I said, oh my gosh, you know, this is right on the money. And by this time, flight attendant comes and says, Mr. Ellis, the captain would like to talk to you. Okay. All right. Okay, new and old forms. If you'd like, if you really want it, I can maybe put this on a maybe I can put this on the blackboard. All right. Would that be okay? All right. Okay, new and old form. Declaration of Islamic and Islamic State. Okay. Or the Caliphate. See, that's what they wanted to do with Afghanistan. See. So, all right. And this will be between 2013 and 2016. All right. Phase 5. This is right from their stuff. All right. Total confrontation. Islamic army will begin the fight. What? Between the believers, the Muslim, Dar al Islam, right? And the non believers, Dar al Islam, the infidels, okay? That's just what they want. This is exactly what they want. Total confrontation. Osama bin Laden predicted this. Alright. Of course. This should begin around 2016. These years might be off, but you can see how they're working on all this stuff, all right? All right, and then phase 7. Definitive victory. All right, the terrorists believe that the Caliphate will prove victorious, and this is because the rest of the world, check this out, will be beaten down by an army of 1.5 billion Muslims. That's the whole thing. They want to wear us down, you know. All right. That should be completed by 2020. And that's what the guy says. That's straight from his mouth. Okay. All right. I hate to start off the day like this. But anyway, that's the Sunni perspective, all right? Now let me show you the Shiite perspective. This is some stuff that I picked up. Who is it? World Domination. Should be in here somewhere. Oh, there it is. Islamic Plans for World Domination. I should say Shiite Plans for World Domination. Okay, now here's their perspective on it. And it's different. You know, it's a different thing. But and in here I got a quote from Colonel Gaddafi. Okay. Here's the Shiite Crescent. The Shiite Crescent. There it is. All right, now the Shiites, they are a minority of Islam, but again, they are better equipped for this thing because they have a theology of suffering, or a doctrine of suffering. And so they see themselves as, you know, like, okay, all right, you got the army and then you got the Marines. The Marines are looking for a few good men, you know. The Shiites see themselves like that, all right? So there's your Shiite crescent. See how important Iraq is to this. Got it? Muqtadir al-Sadr, he wants to be a part of this whole, that's his deal, okay? They don't care about a secular state, you know, they don't want that. All right. So they're trying to bring forth the Islamic. All right. Here's the Shiite strategy for the West, all right? Creating Islamic consciousness. All right, which leads to creating Islamic institutions. Okay, and they're beginning to do that more and more. All right, engaging in political and social structures. All right, engagement. Now, what they mean by that is setting up parallel structures that undermine the existing ones. Okay. All right, the use of jihad is jihad violence as necessary. Okay. That's their strategies. And of course, what is their ultimate aim? Their ultimate aim is an Islamic society. Whether it be in a so-called Islamic area or or not Islamic terrorism. That's what they want to do. They want to create a worldwide Islamic empire. That's what they want to do. All right, and you'll hear this over and over and over again. All right, so that's their general strategy for the West. All right, now, check this out. Check out, this is Colonel Gaddafi. Here it is, straight out of this thing. All right, we have 50 million Muslims in Europe. Remember, I told you that Europe is Islamic, you know, 50 million Muslims in Europe. There are signs that Allah will grant Islam victory in Europe. And if you look at the demographics and do the math, you'll see that that's the way it looks, okay? Allah will grant us Europe without guns, without conquest. 50 million Muslims of Europe will turn into a Muslim continent within a few decades. So he can give up his nukes. He doesn't need nukes. All right? Europe is in a predicament, and so is America. They should agree to become Islamic in the course of time, or else declare war on the Muslims. And if I can just put it bluntly, those are our choices. Based on everything, those are the choices that appear to be coming to us. Either we have to fight Islam, or we're going to have to become Muslim. All right, that's right out of his. That's exactly what his deal is. So now you begin to understand some of these things. Okay. All right. Now, here we go. This is right out of there. All that Arabic. This is their stuff. I'm not supposed to have this. God gets stuff to me sometimes. All right. Here's their deal. They want to declare around 2020 or so. They want to declare a United States of Islam. All right, you see all that? That includes Iraq and Turkey and all that. Even though Turkey's predominantly Sunni, again, they see themselves, of course, disputed territory. And of course, in 100 years, this is really the end of it. All right, that's a bad picture, but anyway, that's the best I can do. Okay, so 100 years from now, that's their plan. Now, it doesn't have to be that way. I'm just, don't get all scared because they have a plan. They never have a plan, But that's their plan, if you really want to know. I'm just informing you. That is, we're talking about the radical Muslims now. We're not talking about the rank and file Muslims out there, all right? We're not talking about that. Remember my axioms, all right? These are the radical Muslims. These are the Islamic fascists. These are the ones who take this stuff seriously, all right? So that's really awesome. That's what they want to see in 100 years. Okay.
Did I see that they left Indonesia out?
Huh?
Did they leave out Indonesia in that map of the United States?
No. Oh, yeah. At first? Yeah, but well,
that's the most populous Muslim nation on earth.
It is.
They're leaving them out.
It is. Well, let's go back and see. Okay. Where's the more cooperating? Okay. Anyway. Yeah, Indonesia, most populous Muslim state, but remember, they're predominantly Sunni. Okay, but these are the Shiites. So the Shiites think they can dominate in those areas. Okay, that's generally what we're looking at. Okay. Okay, all right. All right, and I got a lot more stuff like that. Direct quotations and things. Okay. All right. So we got to take this thing seriously, and I think I suggest to you that, like Neoplatonism was the big deal in the early church. You know what I'm saying? Neoplatonism was the big issue. Like when Arius came in and talks about he doesn't believe in the Trinity. That was the big deal at one time. Whatnot, so forth and so on. I think in the 20th century, 21st century, the Islamic challenge is the big issue that we face today. And it's going to require us to do some good theology. It's going to require us to not just rely on our theology, but to really be in touch with God on this. God is the only one who can give us the wisdom to. Now, let me tell you. There is one possibility here. There are several possibilities. There's one possibility that intrigues me. You know, the Shiites and the Sunnis are bitter enemies. And as they build up this stuff, they just might go at each other. Okay. You know. All right. So. Okay. All right. So where are we? We're going to look at the immigrants, right? Oh, yeah. At the end of this, I've got some. Oh, you know those pictures in, let me see here. This is another document.
Dr. Ellis, why are they enemies?
Huh?
Why are they enemies? How did they become enemies?
Well, because the dispute started early in the time of Islam. They wanted to see a bloodline succession. The Shiites did, and the Sunnis ruled that out. And that was the beginning of it. And then there were other issues. They've gone to war with each other many times. The sectarian violence is happening in Iraq today. It's the bitter. You know how they how the Sunnis the Golden Mosque, or is it the Blue Mosque, whatever, over in Iraq about last year. You know, they hate each other. All right. On the pictures and stuff, identifications. Remember. W.D. Farr, remember Elijah Muhammad? Remember? Okay, yes. Yes.
Sorry. Yeah. I was just wondering, the whole world thing, economically speaking, everybody says that China is the rising power, in a sense.
That's what everybody says.
So what does Islam do about China? Are there Muslims there now? Or is
there are Muslims in China. But here's the deal. China has a rapidly aging and diminishing population. Right? Okay, and the Muslims have a young and growing population, so it's just a matter of time. You know, you're talking about you know, old folks aren't as adventurous as young folks are. You know what I'm saying? But China's emergence as a world power, if all other things are equal, I believe would be overshadowed by the rise of the Islam.
India.
Well, there are more Muslims. India is the second most populous Islamic country. Okay, but India, there's a lot of Muslims there, and they can. The Muslims in India, if they get radicalized and get mobilized, they can give India above China. Okay. All right. These just projections, just general ideas. All right. All right. Muslim immigrants. I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time on this. Some of this I'll skip because I want to get to the video as quick as possible. The Muslim immigrants to America. Okay. You want to look at you want to look at the immigration. I've divided it up into six. Now, there are other people who divide it differently. But I divided it into six great waves of Muslim immigration, okay? And this is easy to fill in the blank, you know, first, second, third, fourth. So you can get ahead of it if you want to. Okay. All right. The first wave began during the 1870s and ended around 1912, mainly from Syria and Lebanon. Now, the reason we look at this is because I want you to see how the Islamic population in America began to change, okay? All right, the second wave starts around 1918 and ends in 1922, okay, from countries devastated from World War I, all right? There's a lot of devastation there, all right? The third great wave of immigration comes... now this is interesting. Again, immigration has an interesting. You have these pioneer immigrants, right? They get established, and eventually they start bringing friends and family over. Okay, all right. So primarily relatives and acquaintances of earlier immigrants. The fourth one begins in the late 40s and ends in the 50s, mainly from India and Pakistan. You know what was going on there. The aftermath of what? The partitioning of India between India and Pakistan, and you remember those tremendous chaos, and the Hindus went south and the Muslims went north and all that. Okay? So that was the fourth one. Now, these are very negligible, all right? And also, some of them were from the Middle East, North Africa, and the Soviet Union. Okay? This is after after World War II. Okay. Now you're beginning to see a slight increase in the waves of war. I'm telling you, it's those X-ray machines. All right. Why am I having this problem? I don't know. I get that problem sometimes. And okay, where are we? Which one are we?
Fifth.
Right, oh, that one?
Yes.
Okay, all right. The fifth wave mainly comes from, it starts during the mid-50s, ends in 1965, mainly from Turkey, all right? Now, something happens to the immigrants between somewhere around 1960, a dramatic change takes place in the consciousness of the immigrants. Up till 1960, they were primarily assimilational. They would come to America and they'd want to assimilate into American culture. That's why in the early days, the early Muslim immigrants, most of them did not stay Muslim. They ended up, you know, all the early mosques that were founded and everything ended up being converted to restaurants and dance halls and churches and stuff like that. Okay. But around about 1960, you see a difference. And let me go back for a second here. Check this out. On the fourth wave, this I missed this because one of the things started going crazy. The fourth wave, late 40s and early 50s, you see another demographic change. These folks, all these other folks are generally uneducated, the rural and all that, but in this immigration wave, you have urban, educated, well-to-do kind of Muslims, okay? So that starts happening, okay? And then you come to the fifth wave, which and I'll get this later one. Later. But to the fifth wave, around about 1960, there's a shift in the consciousness of the Muslims. They went from being assimilational to being identificational. They begin to say, hey, you know, we're Muslim and we're proud of it. So they begin to affirm their own identity. Okay, and that's the change that was significant. All right, and then of course the sixth great wave starts in 1967 and continues to this very day. President Johnson relaxes the quotas. the quotas, the immigration quotas. Excuse me. In 67. So those are the six great waves. And I break it up like that because, like I said, you got to understand the nature of the early Islamic immigrants. It's funny. Sometimes I talk to some African Americans, you know, and I must confess, I bait them sometimes. I say, well, Islam didn't start in the African American community until 1915. You know, Nobel Ali. Oh no. We had Muslims coming over from Africa way back in the 19th century. I said, oh really? Well, who were they? And they start telling me, hey, we had Timothy, and I know who they are. I said, oh okay, that's wonderful. I said, what happened to them? You know what happened to all those guys? All those folks who came? They got saved. And why did they get saved? Because Islam was incapable of dealing with the core cultural issues, and Christianity was. You got it? Mm. Okay. All right. So, now it's interesting, around about 1960, though, you see, what else do you see in America happen? You see just the beginnings of America beginning to turn away. You know, like there was a time when everybody agreed with the core values, right? Even though this country has never been true to the core values. You know, never. Never been 100%. I mean, that's why we had so many social issues. But around about 60, somewhere along there, there is the beginning of America turning away from its core values. And that just opens up a couple of things. Now, that didn't cause these Muslims to become identificational. But having become identificational, and then you run the pattern of America increasingly, you know. See, by the time you get up to the 70s, you got America started to turn away from its own core values. There, this, it, okay, not everybody, There is a group of people in this country. Okay, up to this point, like when we had social problems and all the rest of that, people said we have these problems because this country is not being true to its core values. Live up to your core values, America. That's what the civil rights movement was all about. All right. But then in the 70s and 80s and stuff, you begin to see the emergence of a group of people who say the reason we have these problems is because of the core values themselves. So they want to get rid of the core values. So just when the Muslims can start becoming identification on everything, just when that starts being momentum, America starts to turn away from its core values. At least there are some in America who are trying to get us to turn away, and they are trying to wipe out the core values. And in order to do that, they're trying to knock out the foundations of the core values, namely theism. They want to get it out of the public arena. And so that sets up a situation in which, as these Muslims become more identificational, they're looking at the surrounding society, and they're seeing a society that, at least from the perspective of the news media, the people who are in the news media, these folks are primarily folks who agree with the idea of getting rid of the core values. They see all of this, they see all this influence, and say, this is a decadent society, which only inflames and makes them more identificational. Well, I don't have a problem with people being identificational, but the problem is then they begin to, they become more amenable to hearing about radical Islam because, you see, of the decadence and so forth and so on. You got it? You see where I'm coming from? So anyway, so that's where we're digging a hole for ourselves. All right. I won't spend a whole lot of time on the other stuff here. There are some of these things. You can read this for yourself. The best known families, where they settled, the drums in Cedar Rapids, those were in Toledo, Ohio, Detroit, Michigan. These are the early ones. And notice what the first thing they do is they put a mosque together, okay? And you can read about that. Okay. Sacramento, California. The Punjabs organized, et cetera, et cetera. These are just some of the best known families. Now, those early mosques, remember, most of those early mosques, I think there was one mosque in Michigan City, Indiana, is that right? Those early mosques now, because the Muslim population was primarily assimilational, most of them didn't remain mosques. Okay? There are even some of your immigration figures, Muslims. It's hard to get Muslim immigration figures now, because everybody's so politically correct. But notice there's a big jump between 65 and 68 because of the relaxation of the immigration quotas. And today, it's well over 100,000 a year. Okay. All right. So that's we're seeing an increasing. Now, if you notice, we don't start having national Muslim conferences until about 1952. And these conferences, and notice where the first one is in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, where the first family settled. First, you see, Cedar Rapids. All right. So we start having these conferences in 1952, but these conferences don't really start getting big until about 60, okay? So here are some of these. And these conferences are important because each of these conferences, well, not every one, but a lot of these conferences resulted in the formation of some Muslim organization, all right? All right, so Second National Conference is held in Toledo. Never seen Toledo?
Yeah.
So one of the families. Okay, the third one, there, Chicago. All right. I remember there being a mosque in Gary, Indiana, too. Okay, here we go. The result of it in the Federation of Islamic Associations in the United States and Canada, FIA. Now, eventually, all these organizations are going to come together under one umbrella. That's what I'm driving at. All right. The fourth one, London, Ontario, is New York City, the fifth one. Sixth, Detroit. All right. The seventh, 58,
D.C., the 8th, Michigan City, Indiana.
59. I remember when that one happened. I was living in Gary.
All right. Okay, so those are the conferences, and it shows you what begins to happen. Now, there was one of the organizations, one of the key organizations that was founded. This was after 59, around about 63, I believe. The Muslim student, Islamic student organization, the Muslim student organization. We began to have a lot of Muslims come to the United States. And this is after it started becoming identificational. And the reason that happened, one of the major contributing factors to the Islamic community becoming identificational was the influence of the Islamic students that were studying in the United States. They were younger, and they were saying, okay? All right. And one of the key things, 1963. So there began to arise this consciousness, you see. And then, and it happened on various campuses. And then the organization, so the movement started before 63, but the organization started in 63. If you notice, if you study immigrants, you will notice that, generally speaking, the first American-born generation, okay, you got the immigrants coming, the first American-born generation tends to be assimilational. They don't want to have anything to do with the culture of mom and dad. If I say it in Ebonics, mom and dad. Okay. They want nothing to do with that. They just want to be just straight Americans, okay? Now, the second American-born generation tends to be more identificational. They want to understand what their identity is and all that. Okay. Well, those are general trends. Of course, there are exceptions to that. So you have the Muslim Student Association, and that organization became the most prolific organization because it also led to the founding of several other things. Okay, then you have the North American Islamic Trust, the NAIT they call it, and this is primarily for what? To handle what? Come on, the financial arm. Come on, the financial arm of the MSA. You see this?
Yeah.
Okay. So what are they doing? Well, what are they? How? Where does the money come from? Think of the pillars.
Zakat.
You see, they're starting to pull their zakat, right? All right. And then later on, this organization then they branch out into financing the building of mosques and stuff like that. All right. The Islamic Teaching Center. Okay. All right. There you go. Found it to broaden the activities of the MSA in the larger community. You see what's going on? The Muslim Student Association then leads to a whole lot of other things, all right? And it's a key organization in the Islamic immigrant community. Okay. The Muslim Community Association, founded in the late 70s to coordinate off-campus activities of the MSA. All right? All right. The Islamic Society of North America. That should sound familiar. Founded in 1981 as the umbrella for Islamic organizations. All right, so this is a holding company for all of them. We're going to look at the umbrella just a little bit, okay?
As I'm looking at the dates, is it safe to say that these students are maturing and recognizing the need for a new organization as they grow?
Absolutely. They graduate from college. Some of them become doctors and scientists, and then they start forming the Islamic Society, the Society of Islamic Doctors, the Society of Islamic... I think you see that there. Yeah. Right, exactly. And these are the ones who are really, really, really the key. The keys to the development of organized Islam in this country. Okay, here's some professional organizations. MSA graduates. Okay, there you go. The American Muslim Society of Scientists and Engineers. Okay. The American Muslim Social Sciences. And then here's an interesting one. I've got a couple of cousins that have been to this, the Islamic Medical Association. This is what they'll do. And see, they're not just preaching to the choir. These are evangelistic
Here's what they do. Here you are, a doctor. You're a doctor in Philadelphia. And you get this nice letter. Dear Dr. So-and-so, we recognize, we've heard about your practice. It's wonderful and so forth and so on. And we know that you have many Muslim patients. And we know that you may not really understand, what their sensitivities are and everything. We would like to invite you to a conference, all expenses paid, so we can enhance your ability to serve your Muslim patients better. The dates will be X, Y, and Z, and the conference will be in Maui in the cold winter time.
Hallelujah.
Oh, hallelujah. And we will fly you first class. You can bring your family. And if you'd like, at the end of the conference, you have the option to stay in Maui 5 more days. Would you please come? And of course, you're going to come, right? All right. So it's going to be next year, So you come and they tell you all about it. But what are they going to tell you? They're going to tell you all about Islam and how wonderful and noble it is. And it's all the red carpet treatment and they have won a number of doctors to Islam that way. And some of these other organizations do the same thing. So it's a wonderful thing. Hey, let me go to Maui. I see that white stuff coming down. Hey. All right. So you see what's happening? So these are evangelistic tools and so forth and so on. And they do a very good job of it, okay? Okay. All right. Now, so ISNA, here's the umbrella.
Okay, I didn't like my umbrella.
Okay. Now, remember Islamic Society of North America, right? Remember I told you about that? Now, who's in control of the Islamic Society of North America? Moses al-Sura, the executive council. That should sound familiar. But who are these guys? This is like the board of directors. They run the thing. Who are these guys? You'll find out later. Oh, I'll just tell you now. Anybody want to guess?
Radical Islam.
Okay, well, what's the name of the group? They're radicals. Ikhwan al-Muslimi. Ikhwan al-Muslimi. And here are their constituent organizations, okay? All the organizations that are under their umbrella. There they are. NAIT, you see, MSA, the Islamic Teaching Center, the American Muslim Scientists and Engineers, the American Muslim Social Scientists, Islamic Medical Association, the Muslim Community Association, Federation of International Development, the Canadian Islamic Trust, the Muslim Youth of North America, the Malaysian Islamic Study Group, and here's our old friend here. Check this out, the Muslim American Society. Hello? Remember the Muslim American Society? Organizationally, it used to be. Come on. It used to be the Nation of Islam. But it was transformed into a Sunni group by Waluddin Muhammad. All right. So there are the constituent organizations. Those are all the organizations that are under the umbrella of the Islamic Society of North America. They put out a magazine called Horizons. It would be interesting to subscribe to that if you ever want to. All right. So that's what, and it's a, if you're ever in Indianapolis, go to Plainfield. And go visit the headquarters. It's a big, big old mosque and stuff, they'll greet you warmly, and it's a neat thing. Every now and then I get a letter from them telling me to renew my membership. I don't ever remember joining. So. Okay, so those are the constituents of the ISNA. Now, one other thing I want to show you is the overarching. You don't have it in your notes, but just because I just don't. Again, I don't. If you copy, this is easy to copy. If you copy this and you begin to share it with somebody, don't give me credit for it, please. All right, just say if you came up with it, I'll let you do it. Okay, this you're not supposed to know. Okay, you got the Sunnis and then you got the Shiites, right? Now, under the Sunnis, you have Jamaat Islami.
it translates roughly Muslim community, but it's an organization. It's an organization which controls another organization called the Islamic Circle of North America. All right, that's a direct thing. Then you got the Shiites, okay, and they are in direct control of an organization called the Muslim Student Association Persian Speaking Group. So that's like a subdivision. So the MSA PSG. Okay? All right. So that's your basic thing. Now, watch this. Ikhwan al-Muslimi is Sunni, right? The Muslim Brotherhood. And watch what they control. They control the Islamic teaching movement, the Islamic tendency movement, rather. The Triple IT, the International Institute of Islamic Thought. Okay, what's that all about? They train culture warriors. They train people to think Islamically and frame issues of the day Islamically. All right? By the way, I didn't come up with my idea of the culture warriors from then. Okay, all right. The American Islamic College is located on the North Shore of Chicago. Okay. And then, here we go, the Islamic Society of North America. And everything under that. You see what's going on? Okay, then the Islamic Society of North America then directly is in control of the Muslim Student Association. Okay, association on the bottom there. That's what you're missing. All right. Then what about these guys? The Islamic Circle of North America participates in ISNA and also participates in the Muslim Student Association. So that's the best of my ability. That is the overarching network of Muslim organizations in America. But they're all, the strings are being pulled by Ikhwan al-Muslimi. Now, like I said, they're nice and quite gracious and all the rest of that, but that's who they are. And Esposito will never tell you that. Okay, all right. So much for that. Okay, any questions on that? Okay, yes.
So, I guess to summarize, basically saying all of the major Islamic institutions in the country are ultimately under the umbrella of Islamic radicals.
That's right.
And so they're under the guise of sort of a moderate, whatever.
Oh, yeah. They're coming off all nice and moderate today.
I guess the thing I just have a hard time. Not believing,
I know.
I don't know any better to believe in differently. Yeah. So, but I'm saying like, how do our national leaders not know this?
Because I said it earlier, we don't take religion seriously. Mm. We're so secular minded, and we in the West, let's face it, we have a tendency to look at the Islamic world in our own image. And, by the way, they look at us in their own image. All right? I'll diagram that for you in a second. Okay, I've got a PowerPoint that answers just that. It kind of gives you a difference in terms of the stark contrast in terms of the difference in view. You don't see this in the video. They raided this guy's apartment. They found all this literature all over the room, all the stuff written in Arabic. They just said, oh, that's just religious stuff. And it turns out to be terrorist plans in detail. But the FBI didn't look like, oh, that's just religious stuff. That's, you know. I'm telling you, there are people who are supposed to be in the know who don't know this stuff, okay? But of course, you know, why should they know it? You know, they don't. They got other things to do other than just study Islam. You know what I'm saying? But folks have not understood abrogation and deception yet. They Americans who look at Islam don't, you know, at least at first don't understand, you know, the function of abrogation and deception. For many, many years in my study of Islam, I didn't know that. Okay?
And when I discovered that, it changed. Everything came together then. I was wondering why there was a disconnect between what I was believing about Islam and what I was seeing out there. And once I understood abrogation and deception, it all made sense.
How hard would it be to get this into the hands of government?
Well, I'm sure that some people know that. I know Don Rumsfeld knew this. But he ain't there anymore. I know that. I know he knew that. You know, and the reason I know that is because I know his right hand man. Okay, and I asked him. I said, "What's this?" You know, I share with some of them. Yeah. Rumsfeld knows it. There are people who knew this. But again, remember, you know, you got people on this side, got people on that side. You know, I don't know. Maybe I don't share this in the general public because I'd be persecuted as contributing to Islamophobia. You know, we live in a time where everybody wants to be politically correct. You know, but it's. I know it's far. I understand where you're coming from, and I get disgusted too. But what are you going to do? You know, how is it that I knew that there was going to be a major Islamic strike in the United States back in 1993? Well, because I came across some documents. They had it all laid out there. I just assumed that the government knew. You know, I didn't know. You know, I'm no prophet or nothing. You know, I don't have any special abilities. It's just that I come across stuff and I see it. And I think generally speaking, Americans don't understand. The key to knowing this is understanding abrogation and deception. Yes, I'll get to you, bro. Yes.
It's a different question. So okay.
Is it yours related?
Yeah, you're not saying, I guess, that every mosque in the United States
no.
is underneath the control. You're saying all these Muslim organizations, but not every mosque, right?
Right. Well, but a lot of mosques that are. But let me tell you this. I know Muslims, I know scores of Muslims who don't go to mosque anymore. And why? Because their mosque has been taken over by the Wahhabis. I almost said wasabis. But have y'all ever had wasabi? If you ever have sinus stuff up, you know, clear you out. Okay, yeah. Because their mosque has been taken over by the Wahhabis, the virulent, that's what's going on. And you see some stuff. I mean, not every mosque is that way. Of course, you've got all kinds of, just like not every church is that way. But I'm just saying that the major Islamic institutions, okay, are under the umbrella, under the control of Ikhwan al-Islami. But again, who knows? Some of these folks may not even realize that the executive council is Ikhwan. They may not know that. I don't know. I don't know. I'm not inside of that community, but I know that that's the case. Okay. I've verified this. I've checked this out. From four different people in the know, and they all, matter of fact, they all say that there's even more organizations and stuff under this. This is the simplified, this is the Reader's Digest version, okay? All right.
Given that you think Mr. Rumsfeld was aware of this, and mm-hmm. probably George Bush Sr., I would imagine, is probably aware of it too.
I think George W. is probably aware of it more than people would think.
And he's probably aware as well.
But then what's he going to do? He's getting hemmed in now, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, again, I'm not saying, you know, I think he's made some mistakes, you know, over the past few years. But I think he sees some of this, you know.
Well, there are so many different opinions and high emotions of when we discuss why we went to war.
Uh-huh.
And I'm just curious as to why do you think that the president really...
Because it was believed that Saddam had weapons of mass destruction, that he was going to turn those over to terrorists to be his surrogates to carry out attacks on us. That was it. Huh?
Do you think that's true?
I don't think it's true now. But every indication was, before we went to war, that it was true. Okay, because all the intelligence services said that. Everybody agreed on that. But then on the other hand, they did find substantial caches of weapons of mass destruction recently. Of course, that doesn't get on the news. And what happened during all those months when the inspectors were kicked out? I suspect if you had these huge stockpiles, they might be over in Syria. So I'm saying what I don't, it doesn't appear to be true, but, you know, all the story hasn't fully been told yet. But I think that that was, I honestly believe that that was what the mentality was. It's like the weatherman says it's going to rain tomorrow. All the indications are it's going to rain tomorrow. And something freaky happens and it doesn't rain. You know, that doesn't mean the weatherman lied. He just called it the way he saw it. Now, the only other conclusion I can come to that is that George W. Bush is out of his mind. Okay? And I don't think that that's the case. I may disagree with him, but I don't think he's out of his mind. Okay? I think that the misunderstanding was, I think, in my opinion, when we first went in, we didn't crack down and get tough with the lawlessness. And because we didn't do that, then people look elsewhere for strength, and that's why, and that's a developing opinion on that. Now, please don't take that wrong. I'm not one of these, what do you call it, flag-waving, America-loving believer kind of guy. You know what I'm saying? I mean, if you look at my history, you know, most of my life I've been protesting stuff, you know. But as I look at that, you know, just try to look at it objectively, understanding it, looking at it from the Muslim mentality perspective, I would say that, when I say Muslim, I mean radical Muslim perspective. I would say that, you know, what we did, we were meaning well, but the radical Muslims interpreted it in a whole different way, because we're looking at two different ways of thinking. Okay, so if you're going to fight your enemy, you got to know how your enemy thinks. Okay. Let me show you something that will help to illustrate what I'm talking about in terms of the difference in the mentality of okay, life versus religion. Okay, here's the fundamental impasse. Here's the fundamental thing, and if you understand this, then you have a key to understanding the radical Islamic mentality, all right? Or even the Islamic mentality. This is general. All Muslims in the Islamic world. This is how they think in the Islamic world. The radicals think of it. Now, here's the Western view. Here's the Western view. If life is a rectangle, okay, then what we think, if that's life, then in our view, religion is a small rectangle within it. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Religion is a part of life. Now, if you go to the secular media, you don't even see that. I mean, if you ever notice on TV, you don't ever see anybody going to church except for funerals and weddings. Is that about right?
Sure.
Anyway, I just throw that out there. You know? All right. So the radical secular people want to get rid of that in the public domain, okay? All right. That's the way we look at it in the West. That's our view. So when we look at the Muslim world, we assume that they have the same relationship. Like it's life. That's just religion. See, that's just religion. See? You're gonna have your government out here. Okay, that's the Western view. That's not a Christian view. That's just the Western view. Okay, all right. What do you think the Muslim view is? What do you think the Muslim view is?
One square.
Yeah.
Religion is square. Religion is the center.
All right. Let's see. You know where I'm coming from,
yeah,
right?
You got you.
Okay. All right. There it is. There it is. That's the Islamic view. Now, the problem with our government leaders is they don't understand that. You got it? They don't understand that. And that's just as simple as it can be. But on that, I mean, that's the key to understanding the whole thing. If you really want to understand the Muslim world, that's what you got to know. You got to think that way. And we don't take religion seriously. Okay. That's as simple as I can make it. That's it. Islam is the big thing. Remember? All Islam must permeate all of society. Blah, 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 blah. Now, the radicals just do that on steroids. Okay?
We
do that. So, what? See, the moderates, you know, they see this. Now, every now and then you might have a Western type, you know, a Muslim, especially ones who live over here. Every now and then you might have one of these Muslims who sees it like the Western people do. But a Muslim who knows the stuff is going to see it this way. Now, it depends. Now, to what extent now, I mean, are you gonna, does that mean that you're going to absolutely be like the Taliban, or are you going to be like Turkey? Turkey's a secular state, but even in Turkey, that's the view.
Christians
think
that way.
Yeah, well, actually, what we should do is, I think the Christian view would be, too, and it depends on how you define this, you know, but everything you do should be unto the Lord. We should have a holistic, fully orbed, biblical world and life view. Everything we do is a reflection of who God is. So I think that is probably the Muslim view that I think would be closer to the Christian view than the Western view. But I would think that they would probably be the same, one of the same.
I think a third slide.
Hmm?
I need a third slide.
Yeah, I need a third slide, yeah.
But we don't have a uniform concept of how that is to, of how our faith is to be applied in our culture.
Yeah.
They do.
They do. And you know why we don't?
It's all laid out.
Right. And later on, I think one of the last things that he talks about towards a comprehensive biblical gospel and everything, I'm going to show you part of that. But the problem is simply this, that we in the West, what's ruined the church in the West, forgive me for saying this, is that the church, especially in America, the church has become welfare dependent. The church in America depends upon the American system. It's on welfare dependence of the American system. And so we just assume that all this stuff is done. So what we've done, we've taken the biblical gospel and we've reduced it down to a matter of peddling private fire insurance. And that's it. Now, if you're preaching your message out there, and somebody happens to be in the market for private fire insurance, they're going to hear the gospel. But if somebody is thinking something else, at least they're not going to hear the gospel in terms of what their core concerns are. You got it? And everybody has a right to hear the gospel in their core concerns. Which brings me back to who are the folks who are in the key position to correct that problem? It's people who have Reformed theology. Again, that's the attractive thing about Reformed theology. And again, I go back to my earlier thing, is that it's not enough to be preservationalist. We have to be transformationalist. And if we're not that, then we're not being Reformed. And that's just straight up, and that's what I believe, and I'll stand for that, you know. So there's a whole lot of folks out there in the Reformed community that aren't Reformed. Because they're just, you know, they're just preserving the doctrine. And yes, there's a place for that. Don't get me wrong. We should go that way. But there's just more to it than that. There's more to the gospel than private fire insurance. You know that.
Two comments. One, the concern I have with this is that the secular mindset in America looks at that and sees both radical Islam and biblical Christianity. There is not a differentiation in their mind.
Exactly.
It's all dangerous. Yeah. Fundamentalism.
Of any stripe
is the problem. Right. So
and so therefore, what they want to do, they want to treat Christianity like we treat smoke.
Exactly.
You know, this is a smoke-free zone. See. Smoke was only allowed in designated areas, right? Or outside. This is the smoke free. So they want to have, this is a religion free country, and they want to, right.
You got to somehow work that problem and draw the distinction. And then my second question, we haven't talked about this. What about the Jews? Where does the Jewish community fall out with respect to this stuff? I ask this. My husband is Jewish. And as I've been telling him about this class, his eyes are popping open. Not for the gospel, but he's, this whole thing is unnerving him a bit.
It should unnerve him.
But, and yet, he's generally conservative, a supporter of the president, and he's atypical among American Jews. Can you speak to that at all?
The most remarkable thing to me is that when you look at Jews, they're all across the board. Karl Marx was a Jew, for crying out loud. You know what I'm saying? You got all these the people who want to get rid of the biblical theism in the public domain. The Vanguard, the ACLU, it's Jewish people who put that together. Now, granted, the Protestants helped that out because they said, separate. They were fighting the Catholics so much.
Yeah.
But they created laws which provided precedents for, But, yeah, they're all over the board. They're all over the place,
But they sink a lot of... they've got a lot of money, and they're putting it into... they're very pro-Israel.
Mm-hmm.
They're sending... there are organizations... I guess my question, my sort of global question is, to what extent are they getting this? In the ways that you're presenting it.
I think Israel, if you were to talk to the leaders of Israel, share this with them, this thing about deception and all that stuff, they say, oh yeah, we know that. I think they know that.
Okay.
I think they know that very well in Israel. All right. Now, not that they would be all that Jewish,
yeah.
I'm saying. They're strong stuff because they know what the deal is. Okay, now this last time, I think they tried to fight the battle in Lebanon with one hand tied behind their back. Now again. See, they got a dilemma, And see, the Muslims, they're going to use your values against you. They're going to force you, if you fight, they're going to force you to have collateral damage, which they know that bothers you. Of course, they can maim and kill and do whatever they want to, but they got you over that. And I don't know, as a Christian, how do I resolve that dilemma? That's a terrible dilemma. But Jewish people... Generally speaking, I find, about 3 times ago when I was over in London, I got invited to meet with the Jewish whatever ISNA is, the British Jewish ISNA, whatever that thing was. I forgot the name of it. But my goodness, to get into the building, I had to go through all the security and all this stuff. And we met and we talked about some stuff, and they had some concerns. They're very concerned about this. I think Jews, generally speaking, except in people like Esposito, Jews, generally speaking, have some very deep concerns about these things. Because, so many of them have seen this kind of thing happen before. All the anti-Jewish rhetoric. A young man in Germany used to say stuff like that, too, and people didn't take him seriously. And the rest of that story. So... I say Jews would probably generally, if I was to go to a synagogue and share some of this, I think they would say, yeah, you're right. They wouldn't be disturbed about it, but they would agree, I would think. I generally have had a pretty decent relationship with the Jews that I've talked to. Guys like Esposito.
Yeah. I know one guy who's quite conservative, and he feels... Not my husband, this is a a friend of ours, and he feels like a real loner. He said, I don't understand. He can't understand it. He was telling us a year ago, I don't understand why the Jewish community doesn't get on board with Bush. They don't get that he is standing between them and this stuff. And, that was his observation.
Human nature, and, by the way, speaking about Jews, when I was taking Hebrew, I used to go out here to the synagogue on Old York Road.
Oh, yeah.
It looks like a big hat.
Franklin, yeah.
Bene, something, Beth, something.
I know.
Anyway, I used to go out there, and I used to, you know, sing out of the Hebrew Bibles, you know. Yashalom, da-da-da-da-da, you know. So it's one time I'm doing this, you know. And this Jewish guy said next to me, he said, oh, here. He looked at me and said, I can't read this stuff. Okay. I just did that to practice my Hebrew, you know. So. And it was interesting that they would have, in the hymnal, they would have, you come across this. You know what that is, right? Okay. They would come across that, and they would say, Adonai. Because they don't want to write the word, you know, Yahweh. Or they don't want to say it because they don't want to see it in vain. I think it was a conservative. That's a conservative synagogue, right? Okay. All right. You know, I'm going to show you some other stuff. Well, we'll get to that. There's some loose ends in the African American thing I want to pick up on you. But let's look at the Muslims. Let's look at Islam and the Anglo-American community. Did you see on the syllabus this book I recommended? Poston.
Yeah.
The Changing Face of Islam in America. All right. So I took some of Larry Poston's stuff and I synthesized it and I came up with this. Okay. He did a study. He did a study of Anglo-American converts to Islam. Okay. So this is more of a demographic kind of a study, but this reveals a lot of stuff. Okay. Okay, the first thing that Poston did, he took two studies as a control group here. He took two studies of Anglo converts to American, you know, Anglo converts to Christianity. Okay, one by a guy named Starbuck and another one by a guy named Gillespie. So 1900 and 1979, okay. So he took those two studies and he looked at those because he's going to compare converts to Christianity versus converts to Islam, okay. Okay, so both studies reveal a similar profile, namely that the converts were about 16 at the time of their conversion, generally speaking, on average, okay, about 16 at the time of their conversion. Okay, all right, so, all right, now, check this out. Why did they become Christians? Why did they become Christians? And so some of their reasons were fears, okay, other self things, regarding motives such as I wanted the approval of others, my father died, I thought I would see him again, etc., 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 etc. Those kind of things. All right? Altruism. Okay. I felt that I must do a better job, to do more good in the world. These are major reasons. Following a moral ideal, remorse for and conviction of sin, response to teaching, okay, example and intimidation. Response to teaching. I could tell you some stories about that, but anyway, I won't. All right. Urging and social pressure. You know, come on, you gotta get saved. All right. The need to integrate the various aspects of life into a unified whole. Now that reason, that's the only reason that converts to Islam had in common with converts to Christianity. Okay. The need. Now, so if you notice this. Now again, what does that speak to? You know, who has the theological tools to do that? It's Reformed theology, you see, because, again, we have the capability. What's happened, I think too many of us have degenerated into what I would call Reformed fundamentalism. just preserving the doctrine and jumping on people who, I'm going to shut up. Okay, so Starbuck observed that women were nearly twice as likely to convert to Christianity as men, and the motivating factors leading to Christian conversion were largely irrelevant in Poston's study of converts to Islam, especially with regard to sin. Okay, because remember, Muslims don't believe that they need a savior because they don't believe they're sinners in a Christian sense. You see that? So the sin thing, Muslims, once people become Muslim and they're trying to do this stuff, that's when they really believe. That's when they really understand how devastating sin is. Okay, now let's talk about the profile of the convert to Islam. Here's how it generally goes. Okay, at about age 17, the Muslim convert had grown dissatisfied with Christianity and consciously rejected it. Okay. All right. Now, they reject Christianity, but they don't reject religion in general. You see that? They reject Christianity, but they don't reject religion in general. Now, we're gonna infer what it is about Christianity that they rejected. All right. All right. So they went through what Eric Erickson, who's a psychologist, he calls a moratorium period. Moratorium period. Okay. This is when they start dabbling in other stuff, mysticisms and stuff like that. Again, if you read the Cat Stevens story, it follows this absolutely right down the middle. I mean, it's amazing how classic this story is. Okay. So, they converted to Islam in about 29 after much thinking and reflection. So now you see, they're converting to Islam when their rational faculties are more developed, you see, and it's not so emotional. Okay. And a number of these converts said they felt that they had always been Muslim without even knowing it. Well, what does that lead to? I think that's basically a reflection of the Islamic teaching that we're all born Muslims anyway. That when we convert to Islam, we actually revert. Okay. All right. So I took Poston's data. This is the crazy world in which we live, okay? Larry and I conferred a lot on the telephone. I've never actually met him face to face. The only way I would recognize him is his picture on the back of the bill. But I asked him to send me some of his data, and I'm gonna see if I can crunch the numbers. So he sent me the data, and I crunched the numbers and stuff. And I put together this chart, okay? It's not up completely yet, but I put together this chart, this diagram, and I sent it back. I said, "Hey, Larry," I said, "here's a diagram that I put together based on your data." He said, "You won't believe this," so he emailed me back. He said he had developed the exact same chart. Exactly. Okay. All right. So, so here we go. Here's the way it goes. Converts to Christianity versus converts to Islam. Okay, let's look at converts to Christianity. Okay, they generally became Christians at about age 15, right? Conversion to Christianity. And then from there, they either grew or they backslide or whatever, all right? They backslid. And they finally come to, some became functional Christians, doing fine, and others dysfunctional Christians, okay? Okay. Now, there's another possibility. Some begin to drift away, and that was kind of like their moratorium period. Well, they get to their mid-20s, and they're getting married, and they're starting to have children and stuff like that. They say, you know what, I got to raise my kids on something. So what happens is that they return to spiritual values. And so they veer off of the path of becoming dysfunctional, and they become functional again. Or they, you know, okay. So that's the general profile of the Christian. Now, if we look at the Islamic convert, at age 17, he or she grows dissatisfied with Christianity. Then they go through a moratorium period where they dabble in various religious systems and stuff like that. And at age 29, then they convert to Islam. Different profile. All right. So they convert to Islam. So they, in their present reality, either they are practicing Muslims or dissatisfied Muslims. Okay. So the soft underbelly of Muslims on the bottom. It says Muslims on the bottom. And over here it says Christians
on the bottom. Okay, I'm sorry, I got this cut off. All right, so the soft underbelly is here. Why are they dissatisfied? Because they realize that it's all this legal stuff. You know, remember? Ilm, you know. Now, a lot of them, of course, become Sufi because of that. But even mysticism doesn't do it. So that's the general profile when you look at those compared side by side. Now, we're going to look at some demographic stuff. And all this isn't in your thing, but okay, specific reasons for conversion. I think you might have this. Yeah, there you go. Specific reasons. What were the specific reasons why they gave for converting to Islam? Now, look at these specific reasons and reverse engineer it. And you will understand the specific reasons why they became dissatisfied with Christianity. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so here are the specific reasons. In Islam, questions are faced and answered. Hello? So they were dissatisfied with Christianity because that didn't happen.
I mean, Christianity has answers. So is the issue that that there were no answers given?
The problem is, the Bible has the answers. The problem is the church has neglected so much of biblical teaching that gives us answers. Again, think of the window. We're only on one quadrant of the window. See, the problem is the church. The church needs to rediscover the wholeness of the gospel. It's time for another reformation. I'll get into that later. Okay, here's another one. Islam is a supremely rational religion. And I remember some of the side comments that say, well, Islam doesn't have irrational teachings like the incarnation and the Trinity. That's not irrational. But again, we don't do a very good job of teaching that stuff, okay? Islam's emphasis on the universal brotherhood of man. Now, you might say, now, hold tight. What is all of this? I mean, aren't the Shiites fighting the Sunnis and this and that and blah, 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 blah? Yeah, they are, right? And don't the radicals condemn the moderates as being non-Muslim? Yeah, and all that. So what about all of that stuff? See? What about the assassinations of the early caliphs? What about all that? You know what they say? They say, yeah, we know about all that. But with all of that, the Muslims do a better job of having a brotherhood than the Christians. The Christians fight each other even more. Now, that's not true, but these are perceptions, okay? All right. Islam's focus on the present life. What's the number one reason given why you should become a Christian in America?
Go to heaven.
Yeah, so you go to heaven when you die. Okay. Islam's lack of a priesthood or other human mediators. Now, what does that reflect? That reflects a denominational tendency. What denomination?
Catholic.
And you'll see when we look at the demographics, the largest slice, the largest denominational slice, specific denominational slice from which converts of Islam come are Catholics. So you look like Cat Stevens is a Catholic. Okay. All right. So those are some of the questions. Those are some of the specific reasons given.
Oh, can I get the last point? The lack of a priesthood in the human mediator.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what about the Sufi kind of like
The Sufi master.
Yeah. What's that?
Well, the master is not a mediator. The master, he just guides you on the path so you can get to Allah. He's not a mediator. He's a guide. He's a guide.
So it's basically, he caters to human autonomy.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, okay, you're a Catholic, right?
Uh-huh.
All right. So, you know, you got patron saints you pray to?
Uh-huh.
I know. I used to pray to mine all the time. I was St. Francis of Assisi, you know? and now it's St. Bubba of Assisi. No. Okay. I mean, you pray to saints, you pray to Mary, you know, Holy Mary, Mother of God, pray for us sinners now to the hour of death, amen, you see, you know, the human mediators, you see, Jesus, I mean, you know, the Muslims say, well, we don't even go to Jesus, we have to go straight to God, all right,
And the priest, you know, I remember, you know, the priest, you got to build it.
So the it's also the sacramental system.
Yeah, all that stuff, yeah. You know, I remember. Here's a little story back when I was a Catholic. I was new in the Catholic faith. You know, in those days, you go up there and you stick your tongue out. They put the host on your tongue. You remember that?
Oh, yeah.
Well, I committed a mortal sin because I went to church with my cousin one time. And he was a Catholic, and I didn't know any better, but I went and took communion, and I wasn't even a Catholic. But anyway. So I took the host, and I started chewing it.
Oh, no, no, no. Biting Jesus.
Exactly. The rest of that day, I was in Catholic school. I had to kneel by the garbage can for the rest of the day. Well, you're supposed to let it melt in your mouth.
Let it melt. Oh.
See, the host. It's not the wafer. It's not the bread. It's the host. The host, what? It's, you know, transubstantiation. You see, the priest actually changed it into the body of Jesus. So when I bit down on it, I was inflicting pain on Jesus. Oh,
that's right.
Man, that's terrible, man. That's almost a capital offense. He's suffering all. He's suffering enough as it is. All our sins. Every day on the cross, he suffers, right? Every day
I'm telling you, place, right? He is so right. Because I grew up with that, too. The nuns were, my goodness.
And then the nuns, I don't know where they came up with this from, but it seems like this is the universal culture. If you were talking to some of the nuns and get a piece of chocolate, they were good at it. If they were really mad at you, they'd throw an eraser.
Oh, my goodness.
And how many kids were in the class, Carl?
Oh, about 30.
Oh, 30? Yeah. Let's see. Oh, I was 50,
yeah.
55.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I had one class that was a lot.
It's like these classes.
But you know what? They maintained discipline, though. They maintained discipline. But there was one time. This is no guy. Sister Dill, Sister Ma. I'll never forget her. I liked her a lot. She turned around and everybody's on the she read this. I tell you haven't lived yet. So anyway. You know, I look back on those times. I learned a lot. You know? Yeah, but you never chew the host up. My goodness, that was awful. I didn't know any better, you know. She ridiculed me that whole day. Chew the host. Anyway. And I used to learn that, well, you know. I sensed the call, you know, remember? And I was studying to be an altar boy, but I couldn't get the Latin together. Anyway, praise him. Okay, so here we go. Remember I said they become Muslim around 829? So you see the biggest slice? All male, female. The general thing is that they, you know, that replaced that. Okay, so let's look at reasons of conversion. Okay, here's the data. It's just the percentages. I didn't have the actual numbers. You know how to do all that stuff. Come on. Okay. Okay, so that's my age group. Now we're going to look at reasons of conversion because of religious background. Okay. Now, here's something that's interesting here. I notice Catholic is the green here. Now, that's not the largest slice overall, but notice this. Not specified is the largest slice. Now, what does that indicate? That indicates that at the time they became Muslim, they were already in the moratorium period. You got it? So, whenever you have that kind of a thing, you know, or undecided or whatever, you divide it up among the other slices. You know what I'm saying? According to the proportions. Here's general Christian. That could be early stages of the moratorium period. You got it? So generally speaking, then I'd say probably of the specific denominations given, the Catholics were the largest. All right. So there's your data. You know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Okay. Yeah.
Did you ever cross-check the percentage of, I mean, just how many people are in the Catholic Church in America, and how many people are turning to Islam compared to the Protestant Church?
Well, it's a small minority. Yeah, it's not that much, but it's
because I was just wondering if it's a smaller minority than the Protestant Church. I mean, are we losing more people to Islam? That would be
a good study. That would be an interesting study. I'll call Larry and see if we can put together something. I had a similar thing on this on African Americans, similar breakdown like this for my dissertation. And I was almost at the end of it, and then my hard drive went bonkers and destroyed it all, everything. And I said, oh, not to worry, I got 5 backups, right? I found out that it was a Western Digital drive. Never use a Western Digital drive. And for months I had been backing up. The drive was bad from Jump Street. And when I back up, all it would do is put the names of the files on the tape. And all the files were empty.
Oh,
so needless to say, I went into a funk. I was in a funk for months. But anyway, I found similar stuff, okay? All right, so here are reasons. I'm sorry, some of these are, go ahead. Some of these are cut off. Don't worry about this. Down here was Islamic unity. Here is reading. And here is other. Okay? So here are your things. Now, let's look at that purple one. Look. Do you see the largest slice? The largest single slice? Look at this.
Witness
of a friend. You got it? All right. And another one here. Islamic morality. That's another one. See? All right? And I'll travel to a Muslim land that... You know, they saw Islam put into practice and stuff like that. Now, what I'm going to do with this, I'm going to take these and I'm going to combine a lot of the categories. We're going to come down to 4 larger categories. Witness of a friend stands on its own, but I'm going to show you the reason why. And at the end of all this, then we're going to put together the typical profile of the Anglo-convert. And by the way, this profile applies to African-Americans too, with the exception that some of the age... I came up with a very similar thing. Of course, instead of the largest denominational slice being Catholic, what was it among African Americans?
Baptist.
Okay, all right. But of course, why? Because the largest slice of Christians among African Americans are Baptists. Okay, now here we're going to do the religious background. Of those who specified the denomination, the largest group identified themselves as former Catholics, remember? Okay, I'm going through something I said earlier. 25% did not specify a religion. Okay, there's the men and the women. Now, this could be the result of them having rejected Christianity. I said that earlier. And if so, then if you divide it all up here, then 84.3% consider themselves a former Christian. Check this out. 84.3% of Anglo converts to Christianity consider themselves to be former Christians. Okay. All right. That's interesting. And of course, in the African American study, it revealed something very similar. It's more like 90 something. Okay. Now, check this out. Now, I'm going to take broader categories, okay? Broader categories. All right. Now, we're going to combine some witness of a friend standing on his own, okay? The witness of a friend indicates friendship evangelism. Okay. The friend was able to completely articulate his faith, his Muslim faith. Okay. He was able to do that. The friend did not depend on an Islamic speaker to convey that message. The friend was able to articulate his Islamic faith. Only 6.2% came because of an Islamic speaker. Now, how many times do we as Christians just say, well, why don't you come to my church? I want you to hear my pastor. That becomes the basis of our witness. You know. Now, of course, y'all are Westminster students, you see, and you're going to be able to do this. You know, you're going to be able to articulate in a presuppositional manner. You know. but I'm talking about the congregations we work with. You know, somehow that the people that we train and everything, the people that we work with, are going to have to learn how to articulate their faith. Okay, Islamic morality includes a strong concern for ethics. That's another one of those categories that stands on its own. Islamic morality. So they became Muslim because friendship, witness of a friend, the strong concern for ethics. Okay. The content of Islam, now that's a broader category, and I'm going to include in that the simplicity of Islam, the rationality of Islam, and Islamic teaching. Okay, I'm going to include all of that under the content of Islam. All right. The practicality of Islam, I'll lump all the rest of the categories under there. That is the this world orientation of Islam, travel to a Muslim land, okay, seeing it applied, okay? So we're gonna reshuffle all that stuff and come up. We've got these four categories, all right. So let's look at them. Okay. So we're gonna do some pie charts here. Okay, is that right? Yeah, statistics of the broader categories. Okay. The content of Islam. 53.2% of those who came to Islam came because of the content. They thought it was rational. Practical, okay, you got it? Questions are answered, and so forth, okay? So the content of Islam. All right, so that's 52%. And all of these categories can overlap, okay? All right, how about the relationship evangelism, 43.8? The friend was able to articulate the faith to the person, okay? 43.8%. And it's half of them. That's almost half of them. Okay? And then we have, there you go, the practicality of Islam. There we go. 28.1%. It was practical. You can do it in life. And then finally, we have a strong concern for ethics, which is 25%, if I remember right. Yeah, that's right, 25%. So there you go. So now you're looking at the profile of an Anglo who is very likely to become a Muslim unless they hear a clear biblical message. Okay, all right. So what did we conclude from all of this? Okay, here we go. Okay, the typical Anglo convert to Islam considers him or herself a former Christian. Got it? Was influenced through the witness of a friend who articulated the faith and persuaded them to embrace Islam. Was persuaded because they saw Islam as the fulfillment of their desire for practical content in a faith that is intellectually consistent and or their strong concern for ethical issues. Okay? This is the profile. Yes.
I'm kind of hard to see how Islam is intellectually consistent.
Well, you don't, because you understand how intellectually consistent Christianity is. But then, on the other hand, you're studying at Westminster. But you go out there in the rank and file out there, and folks don't know anything. They don't know. How do you think? We saw Farrakhan last night. You know. And just lay up a man crown. You know, come on. I mean, you know, it's just, he has these echoes of, you know, I mean, this, you'd be surprised what people don't know. You'd be surprised. In our churches, people don't know much.
All of a sudden, my son had a conversation with an Anglo that's thinking about Islam.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what he said. He said the reason why the rational part, the intellectual consistent part was, there was no mystery. He didn't have to struggle with the mystery. And he pointed this out, the mystery of God loving us, mm-hmm. incarnate himself. Mm-hmm. That doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
If God's supposed to be this transcendent
right.
being,
right.
Allah
right.
is only transcendent.
Right, that and that's makes it. Sense. That's all there is. Tell me. Now, check this out. Here's another reason. I don't say it here, but here's another reason. Do you know what percentage, the large percentage of Christians out there who are practicing Christianity as a works righteousness religion? That's one of the big problems.
Yeah.
And Christianity doesn't make a good works righteousness religion because there's too much leeway. You know, too much fuzziness. You know, you can't, what are you supposed to do? But in Islam, it tells you exactly what to do.
Exactly right.
If you want to blow your nose, I bet you there's a hadith somewhere that tells you what hand to blow it in and what angle to blow it in. It's all laid out for you. See, there's no question. You see, and that's why. So a lot of people see. You know, people don't understand. People lose the doctrines of grace. If you lose the doctrines of grace, your Christianity is totally useless. And it makes more sense. If you're going to be works righteousness, if works righteousness is the way to do it, then Islam makes a whole lot more sense than Christianity.
And maybe we shouldn't take those kind of criticisms too seriously, too, because I know that Islamic converts from Christianity, if they come in and they start really criticizing Christianity, I was a Christian, oh, that's going to get the Muslims excited. That's the kind of conversion story they want. So they tend to trump it up and ratchet up
I was their a born again. I was a born again fire baptized Christian.
It was inconsistency I saw. I'll preach it. They just keep on going. That's the stuff they want to hear.
But we're talking about those who answer the Christian questions. You see. But it could be the same thing. They're trying to witness to the Christian. You know, they're trying to witness to Larry Poston. That's a fact. That's a factor. But then, as I talk to these folks and I get deep in conversation with them, that's what they come out and say. Well, in Islam, it gives you a guide. It tells you what to do, what you got to do, because they're thinking of Christianity as a works righteousness religion.
Yeah.
See, mankind has a bad case of grace intolerance. You know, if you read scripture, you see this all the time. You know. We just cannot get that together. We want to, how does Bantil talk about would be autonomous man? You know, we know what I mean. You know, and that kind of flies in the face of our thoughts of autonomy, the fact that we are totally dependent upon the grace of God, and that my eternal destiny is not even dependent ultimately on my decision. It's God. You know what I'm saying? Yet and still, I do make a decision. You know what I'm saying? So yeah, there's no mystery. That's the thing. See. All right. And of course, if you have no mystery in God, then God's got to be finite. When you think about it. Oh, let me share this with you. I was talking to a Muslim one time. He said,
"Yeah, well, you Christians, y'all divide God up into three parts." I said, "What are you talking about?" "Yeah, you know, the Trinity. You know, everybody knows the Trinity is mathematically impossible."
I said, "Oh, really?" He said, "What are you? Explain it to me."
He said, "Yeah." So he said, look at this. 1 + 1 + 1 + 1 is not equal to 1, right?
I said, Oh, I see now. So I said, "Well, it's interesting that you would choose a particular binary operation. You know, there's four you can choose now. Why choose that one?" He said, "What do you mean?" I said, "Watch this now." I said, No. "Let me give you some knowledge now. And I was at a dialogue. You know, there's hundreds of people looking out. He didn't know what to say. I said, "This is more consistent because he says, 'I am in the Father, and the Father is in me,' you know." And then on another occasion, somebody started getting on this Trinity business.
"Yeah, man, the Bible don't say nothing about the Trinity."
I said, okay, that's fine. I said, "Let me ask you this question." See, this is when I'm in my presuppositional stuff, right? I said, "Let me ask you this question." I said, "Is God infinite or finite?" "Oh, man, God's infinite. I said, "Okay. Is God limited by anything outside of himself?" "Oh, man, he's not limited by anything outside of himself." "Is God limited by any finite human concept?" "No, man, God ain't limited by that." I said, "Okay. So, you believe God is one? I believe God is one. But the difference between us is the way we look at it." I says, "Now, is God's oneness limited by the finite human concept of one?" And then he said, No. "But you said no, right?" So I said, "Okay, that's all I'm saying. I'm going to leave it right there. I'm not going to get any further, you know." So, but again, what did that do to him? That put a crack in his dam. You know, you could have any dam out there. You put a crack in it, you just put a little crack in it. You walk away. Did you say... Did you ever see a movie called Force 10 from Navarone? Anybody seen that movie? You know, they're going to blow up this thing in the Balkans, and they put it the dynamite, said boom, you know, and nothing happened. The guy says, oh man, this is a waste of time. The guy who did it, he says, just sit tight. Let nature take its course. You know, oh man. And then after a while, you see a little trickle of water come through, and then a stream, and then a gusher. And it took about 10 or 20 minutes for the thing. Eventually, the whole dam collapsed. You know what I mean? So just put a little crack in the dam and walk away. You know, touch me in the morning. Okay. Walk away. Okay. Okay. All right. So anyway, how did I get on this? I'm chasing a rabbit trail here. Okay. So here we go. These Anglo converts to Islam evidently perceive that Christianity is void of practical content, intellectual consistency, social ethics.
Hello.
Remember our windows?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, social ethics. And evangelicalism's almost exclusive focus on private salvation exacerbates that perception. Okay? I'm telling you, please, when you get out there, don't be like the unjust steward and bury your wonderful theological training. Please, figure out ways to get it out there in places where it hasn't traditionally been. Because I'm telling you, folks, Christians are hungry for what you got. You know, you pick rocks around up here on this hill, and you don't know they're precious gems. You know, now you got to polish them up a bit. You know, you got to make it. You got. Oh yeah, by the way. And learn the language of the people and express it in the language of the people. Don't use your, you know, up here we use cryptic language, don't we? You know, all right. Well, African Americans share some of the same reasons for converting to Islam, okay? In my study of African American converts, some of those same reasons were present. But the difference is, only with African Americans, there were some additional reasons related to the issues of dignity, identity, and significance, okay? All right. And if things continue as they are, we will see a dramatic increase in Anglo-American converts among the 20, 30-something group. And the age of the Anglo-American-born convert will grow younger. Okay. So, of course, we know that's already happened among African-Americans. If you do that profile among African-Americans, they would come to Christ at about 20, 21, 22, that kind of thing, instead of 29. All right. So that's your Anglo convert, okay? And, all right. Okay, let's take a quick break, and we're going to finish up this Islam in America, I think. And, or I tell you what, you want to, let's take a quick break and jump into the. You want to hang on for another. No, let's take a break.